And tonight, I'm going to be talking about chapter 16, which is called, at least in the English translation I'll be using, the lifespan of the Thus Come One. Meaning, Thus Come One is basically means the Buddha, another title that was given to the Buddha. Can I just ask, how many people here are kind of reading at least a little bit of the Lotus Sutra now and again? Anybody? Oh, a couple of people. Good, good. It is online if you want to dive in and look at a couple of chapters and just see what it's like. Quite interesting because it's so different from the other kind of Buddhist texts that we often read, particularly the early texts from the Pali Canon, but also from the other Mahayana texts. So if you haven't done that yet, just Google and dip in, read a little bit, and see what you think. So this chapter, the chapter 16 that I'll be talking about, presents one of the key teachings of the Lotus Sutra. And as we'll see, and as has been true of the earlier chapters, really uses storytelling and metaphor to bring forth the teaching. It's not laid out in a philosophical way at all. But in the chapter, we'll see that the Lotus Sutra really is laying the groundwork here for the Mahayana understanding of what's called a Buddha nature. I'll talk about that a little bit more. So, if you've been listening to any of the talks, or if you were here on Sunday, it's a very exciting day on Sunday, right? There's quite great events happening in the Lotus Sutra. At the end of the chapter, that was called Emerging from the Earth, which Kate talked about, countless bodhisattvas, numerous as the sands of 6,000 Ganges, came out of the earth and came before this grand assembly of beings. So, the basic storyline of the Lotus Sutra is the Buddha is going to present the Lotus Sutra, and there's these myriads of beings that have gathered around him on Eagle Peak or Vulture Peak, depending on the translation, to listen to him. And at this point, these bodhisattvas that have emerged from the earth, the Buddha says, these are the bodhisattvas that are I'm going to be kind of carrying on my teaching when I'm gone. And as you can see, they're countless. So we'll explore what that may mean in a few moments here. So according to the Buddha, these bodhisattvas that sprung out of the earth, which no one had seen before, kind of like ninja bodhisattvas, perhaps. They're ninja bodhisattvas, right? Poof. Will continue to teach the Dharma in this world after the Buddha has gone. Now, this puzzles everyone in the assembly. For the Buddha has only taught for about 40 years since his awakening, according to the traditional story, right? So, how could he have possibly instructed so many bodhisattvas? Remember, they're as numerous as 60,000 Ganges, the sands of 60,000 Ganges. Right? So that's a lot of bodhisattvas. Right? So at that time, as we have seen earlier in the Lotus Sutra, of course, immediately someone springs into verse, because it's either Buddha or one of the bodhisattvas starts talking in verse. And it goes like this. This is the Bodhisattva Maitreya. In the past, the Buddha departed from the Shakya clan, which was the name of his family, left his household, and near Gaya sat under the Bodhi tree. Little time has passed since then. Yet these bodhisattvas of the Buddha are immeasurable in number. It's difficult to fathom. How can anyone believe it? The Buddha attained the way very recently, yet those he helped to gain success are so many. We beg you to dispel the doubts of the assembly. to make distinctions and explain the truth of the matter. It's as though a young man just turned 25 were to point to a 100-year-old man with gray hair and wrinkled face and say, "I sired him." And the old man were to say, "This is my father." Right. And Kate mentioned that on Sunday. So, that was the close of the chapter that Kate dealt with. And then our chapter, The Lifespan of the Buddha, begins with the line, "At that time, the Buddha spoke to the Bodhisattvas and all the great assembly. Ah, good men and women, you must believe and understand the truthful words of the Thus Come One." And the Buddha repeats this three times. You must understand and believe the truthful words of the Thus Come One. In the sutras, and I guess probably at the time and places where the sutras were first composed, to repeat something three times indicated a kind of sincerity and a seriousness. Like, pay attention to what I'm going to say. So, are you paying attention? Shall I repeat it one more time? So the Buddha replied, "Since I attained Buddhahood, the number of kalpas that have passed is an innumerable, immeasurable, hundreds, thousands, ten thousands, millions, trillions, asamkhas." Now we know asamkhas is a lot, right? Do you remember how much an asamkha is? Well, you probably remember, but let me tell you anyway. An asamkha is a numerical unit in ancient India that's used to indicate an exceedingly large number. And one source has it at 10 to the power of 59. And the other source, it's not quite so big. It's 10 to the power of 51. That's an asamkha. 10 to the power of 51. That's 10, right, with 51 zeros. Remember your junior high school math? Something like that. So, it's not just one asamkha, though, right? 10 to the power of 51. It's tens of thousands, millions, trillions of asamkhas. Constantly, I have preached the Dharma, teaching, converting countless millions of living beings, causing them to enter the Buddha way. All this for immeasurable kalpas, in order to save living beings. As an expedient means, I appear to enter nirvana, but it meaning to die and to enter nirvana. But in truth, I do not pass into extinction. I am always here. I am always here preaching the Dharma. I am always here. And just a little bit later, in that same chapter, the Buddha says, "Ever since I have been constantly in this saha world, this world of that we are in, this world of suffering, teaching the Dharma, teaching and instructing, and elsewhere I have led and benefited living beings in hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, and millions of nayutas and asamkhas of lands, of other worlds." Now, you thought an asamkha was pretty large, right? Well, nayuta is also pretty large. I think, if I remember right, a nayuta is it's not that large. It's only 100 billion. It's 100 billion. And then, in order to give his listeners, again, this is still the Buddha talking, right? A sense of this limitlessness and this timelessness of his presence, he gives the following metaphor. Suppose a person were to take 500, 1,000, 10,000, a million nayutas, Right, remember, that's 100 million, right? 100 billion, sorry. 100 billion. A million nayutas. A samka, 1,000,000,000-fold worlds, and grind them all to dust. And then moving eastward, each time he passed 500, 1,000, 10,000, a million nanuta samka worlds, he dropped one particle of dust. And he continues eastward in this way until he's finished dropping all the particles. Good men and women, he's talking to the assembly, right? Good men and women, what is your opinion? Can the total number of all these worlds be imagined or calculated? And they say, nope. They reply, it's beyond thought. It's beyond thought. In early Indic thought, in early India, long before the Greeks or other early cultures, they thought and discussed and wrote in these huge numbers. They used numbers in this way to kind of stretch and pull our imagination. They want us, in some way, I think, to taste timelessness, to somehow taste this idea of infinity. So I was curious, after reading this, how does that compare to how we understand time and space today? And so I went to Professor Google and looked up NASA. I figure, if anybody knows, it's got to be NASA about this stuff. And this is what I found on the website. Astronomers have measured the age of the universe to be approximately 13.8 billion years old. And because of the connection between distance and the speed of light, this means that they can look at a region, astronomers can look at a region of space that lies approximately 13.8 billion light years away. Like a ship in the empty ocean, astronomers on Earth can turn their telescopes to peer 13.8 billion years in every direction, which puts Earth inside a visible sphere with a radius of 13.8 billion years. The word visible here is key because the sphere limits what scientists can see, but not what is there. Although the sphere, so the whole thing, is almost 28 billion light years in diameter, it is actually far larger. Scientists know that the universe is expanding. Thus, while scientists may see a spot that lies 13.8 billion light years away from Earth at the time of the Big Bang, the universe has continued to expand over its lifetime. So it's been expanding for 13.8 billion years. Today, the same spot, that same spot that was, say, 13.8 billion years at the boom, right, is now 46 billion light years away, making the diameter of the observable universe a sphere around 92 billion light years. Are you grokking this? 92 billion light years. However, you may think, well, that's pretty big. But it doesn't stop there. The size of the universe depends a great deal on its shape. Well, who knew? But it's apparently, scientists have predicted the possibility that the universe may be closed, like a sphere, as we kind of picture maybe in our mind, like this huge globe that's 92 billion light years in diameter. It could be curved like a saddle, or flat and infinite. If it's flat, it's infinite. A finite universe has a finite size that can be measured. And this would be in the case of a kind of spheric universe. But an infinite universe has no size by definition, right? Of course, it's infinite, so no size. There's no way to measure an infinite universe. According to NASA, scientists know that the universe is flat. They know it's flat with only a margin of error of 0.4%. 0.4%, the error possibility that it's spherical or saddle-shaped or something. It's definitely within 0.4% margin of error, flat. A flat universe is an infinite universe. The size of the universe is infinite. Now, so the early Indians knew this. I mean, using this wonderful metaphor to describe, you grind up everything in the universe, and after a bunch of light years, you drop a speck, and how far you go, and it. Now, while I appreciate that 13.8 billion years is a long time, I've always had the trouble trying to imagine the distance of a light year. Have you ever had that trouble? Like, how far is a light year? And I find I'm much more moved by the poetic descriptions in the Lotus Sutra of these vast times and infinite space that they give. Imagine all those worlds ground up in a big mortar, and just one speck after many years of traveling. I also find it quite astonishing that the writers of the Lotus Sutra and many other old texts, particularly in the Buddhist texts, thought in terms of such cosmic numbers and felt that this was really important to convey. This is an important part of the Lotus Sutra, these vast numbers, this sense of infinity. And that's exactly, I think, what they wanted to do. They wanted to convey to the readers, to convey to the people who are listening, to give them an inclination, a sense, or a hint of eternity. Perhaps pulling them and pulling us out of our kind of everyday, this is all there is views. It's far bigger. So, now, in the Lotus Sutra, we have the image of the Buddha that is present everywhere and does not die. A Buddha that is unceasingly teaching and aiding innumerable living beings. In an earlier talk in this series, I mentioned the really positive view of the world, of this universe, that's expressed in the Lotus Sutra. And I think here it is again. The Buddha's not some guy who died all this time ago. There's still this presence here. There is this presence. And so not only are there countless bodhisattvas, but also an eternally present Buddha, or Buddha presence, and all of which are dedicated to teaching the Dharma to us, to you, and to me. But remember, as I said at the beginning, the Lotus Sutra is, of course, about skillful means, about using story and metaphor to teach us wisdom and compassion. I don't think that the Buddha kind of presented in this chapter 16 of the Lotus Sutra is some kind of super being or godlike figure, but perhaps a metaphor for our world and a metaphor for our life. In other sutras, other teachings, this Buddha presence is explained or given another name, Buddha nature. Your Buddha nature, our Buddha nature, which is a kind of potentiality, perhaps, for enlightenment that pervades everywhere and through all time. The Tibetan teacher, Dzogchen Ponlop Rinpoche describes Buddha nature this way. He says, and he writes, Our fundamental nature of mind is a luminous expanse of awareness that is beyond all conceptual fabrication and completely free from the movement of thoughts. It is the union of emptiness, or perhaps we could say boundlessness, and clarity, of space and radiant awareness that is endowed with supreme and immeasurable qualities. From this basic nature of emptiness or of boundlessness, everything is expressed. From this, everything arises and manifests. From this Buddha nature, everything arises and manifests. So that the timelessness and infinite Buddha presence or Buddha nature is not something special, not something outside or beyond this everyday world. It is intimate. It is, I think, the fabric of our lives. Dogen Zenji, the Japanese monk who brought this form of Zen Buddhism, the Soto Zen, from China to Japan in the 1200s, helps to clarify this a little bit, I think, in his writing. He says, we do not have a Buddha nature, but we are Buddha nature. We do not have a Buddha nature, but that we are Buddha nature. Does that kind of sense a little difference there between have and we are? The implications of this are of this Buddha nature, of this Buddha presence. These implications are unpacked a little bit further for us a bit later in the chapter of just chapter 16. So let me read you another quote from the chapter itself. The thus come one perceives the true aspect of the threefold world exactly as it is. Threefold world means this world, right? This world, another kind of expression for this. Perceives the true aspect of this world exactly as it is. There is no ebb or flow of birth and death. There is no existing in this world and later entering extinction. It is neither substantial nor empty, neither consistent nor diverse. Nor is it what those who dwell in this world, in this threefold world, perceive it to be. All such things, the thus come one sees clearly without error. Now that may ring familiar to you, may sound familiar to you, at least to some of us, because it echoes the Heart Sutra that we chant at almost every service. The Heart Sutra goes, I'll just read you a couple of lines from that. It goes, from one example, Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither rise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. And another quote, there is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death nor extinction of old age and death, no suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path, no knowledge, no attainment. Does that sound a little familiar? Perhaps. And here we have it in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha saying almost the same thing. There is no ebb or flow of birth and death. There is no existing in this world and later extinction. What are they talking about? Well, these are the teachings of Prajnaparamita, or the teachings of emptiness. That all phenomena, all things, are in an unending flow of interbeing. all things are in an unending flow of interbeing, in a boundless matrix. A flow, like a river, not separate. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is another great sutra, this is expressed in a famous illustration that we call, or is called, Indra's net. Let me give you a quick description of this Indra's net. Maybe this will help. Imagine a mysterious net which kind of stretches infinitely in all directions. And at each node or each eye of the net, there's a single glittering jewel. And since the net itself is infinite in dimension, the jewels are infinite in number. So far, okay? Now, looking closely at one jewel, we see that in its polished surface, there are reflected all the other jewels of the net, infinite in number. Like one of those mirrors, right? You get a mirror in a mirror and you go, infinite number of reflections. And each of the jewels reflected in this one jewel is also reflected in all the other jewels. Why is there no ebb, no birth, no death, no existing and later extinction? Because nothing stands alone. Nothing is separate and fixed from all that surrounds it. The Buddha is telling us that the world is not as we perceive it. Not separate, not fixed. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen teacher, has his students practice with this short gatha, or a poem, short poem that people use for practice. And it goes like this. In the garbage, I see a rose. In the rose, I see compost. Everything is in transformation. Impermanence is life. In the garbage, I see a rose. In the rose, I see compost. Everything is in transformation. Impermanence is life. At what point does the rose become compost or the compost become a rose? I don't know. At what point does the organic and locally grown apple that you have just eaten become you? At what point does it become not you? I don't know. The lines that we draw, the categories that we construct, are conventionally useful. I don't want you to eat my apple. But they don't describe the whole reality of this world. They blind us to the greater truth of how things are. There is no time or place where Buddha nature is not available to us. We do not stand outside. In the Lotus Sutra, we've talked about a number of parables, and there's some more good ones coming up. Sunday and next Wednesday are two good ones. But in this chapter too, there's a parable. And it goes like this. A physician leaves home on a trip, and when he comes back, discovers his sons have foolishly taken large amounts of a poison that is used in preparing medicine. The poison leaves some of the children in deep states of confusion. And then, so the father, the physician father, mixes up an appropriate antidote, which some of the children take willingly and they're cured, but others are too lost in a state of confusion or delusion and they refuse to take it. So the father, after some thought, decides to use a skillful means and tells his children that he's now has grown quite old and wants to take one more trip. And so he leaves home again. And after a short while, he sends back word through a servant that he has died. And the children are all shocked. And the shock actually kind of awakens some of the children who had refused to take the antidote and were confused. And then they come to their senses and they realize their father must have really meant to help them by giving them this medicine, and they take it too. And they take this medicine and they are cured of their confusion. And when the father hears this, he returns home. In this parable, it's really clear that medicine is only medicine if we take it. We will develop or open, I think, to wisdom and compassion only if we practice. Although the Buddha is highly respected and venerated throughout the Lotus Sutra, he's not a savior. He doesn't save. He teaches. The pain and suffering, the sickness, the old age, and death of this world are just how things are. This is the world. It includes these things. In these parables, no one is rescued or saved by force. You know, he doesn't like say, hold that guy down, we're going to pour this into him whether he wants it or not. Everyone is encouraged to save themselves, to help each other, yes, aid each other, yes, but you can't save someone. Everyone is encouraged to save themselves, in other words, to awaken to their true and full nature. At the very end of the chapter, there's a lovely little verse. It goes like this. At all times I think to myself, this is the Buddha speaking, at all times I think to myself, how can I cause living beings to gain entry into the unsurpassed way and quickly acquire the body of a Buddha? Would you like a body of a Buddha? In the Zen understanding, we already have a body of a Buddha. We are Buddha nature. The Lotus Sutra tells us the world is full of bodhisattvas and Buddhas dedicated to our awakening. Buddha nature, this wisdom and compassion, is found everywhere. So I have a question for you. I have two questions for you. How do you express your Buddha nature? And what prevents you? What hinders you from expressing your Buddha nature, your wisdom and compassion? So what we'll do, I think I've spoken for a little longer than I thought. I'd like us, though, to we'll get into groups of three. If you could just kind of cluster around to get three people. And we'll take maybe just about, we got enough time. I'll time you, and we'll just take about 2 minutes or so per person. I'd like you to talk about, like, how do you express your wisdom and compassion? And what kind of helps you, what stops you from that? What hinders you in that way? Okay. So let's just kind of group in groups of three, if you wouldn't mind. And Kate, do you want to pass me a bell? Yeah.